I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to the latest Ramble Meets. I'm Andy Brassel and today's guest is Clive Allen, one that I'm very excited about because Clive Allen is a huge part of my football childhood. The first year in which I regularly watched football, 86-87, was the one in which Clive Allen went on that incredible scoring rampage for Tottenham Hotspur, scoring 49 goals in all competitions. But I've come to know Clive more, bumping into him at BT Sport in recent years. He's always very open and engaging, and I always got little bits of his stories from Tottenham, from Bordeaux, where he went after Spurs, which is a particular interest of mine. And we got into a few of those subjects in greater depth here. I really hope you enjoy it.
So I guess the first thing, Clive, is what was the experience of writing an autobiography like? Was it almost quite nice to become reacquainted with your career?
Yeah, I think so. Just all the memories that come back, the things that you that obviously made a real impact in your life, but also just recalling and actually things that popped up that you might have forgotten about. So yeah, I think it was therapeutic. It was something that was at times it was emotional. Yeah. Working with James Ollie, the author, it was a really pleasant experience, and obviously coming to fruition now with a book being launched and published, and actually seeing it. It's been probably 2 years in the making,
yeah.
And it's something that I've thoroughly enjoyed.
Well, there's a lot to pick through, I guess, and we'll get to some of it. But I guess the thing that surprised me when I first started working with football, and I guess to an extent will surprise a lot of people listening, is the fact that there are a lot of footballers out there, and I would say the majority of footballers, who maybe don't have an encyclopedic recall of their own career. I mean, there's that brilliant story that I really loved in the book about you having an argument with Richard Keys about, no, Keith Houchin scored the winner in the 87 Cup final, and you were really insistent, and Richard Keys is going, no, that's not how it happened. And then you go back and you find that out. I mean, how do you think that works in footballers' minds? Do you think it's because it's such a treadmill that it's easy to lose the thread of the detail?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly that was the case with that particular story, because I think since playing in that 87 Cup final, yeah, and seeing back, you know, you see repeats of it, or you see the goals that were scored in it, and I suppose in a way it became etched on my mind that Keith Houchin's header was the winning goal.
It should have been. It was a brilliant goal.
It was a magnificent goal, yeah. And I was convinced, because I think in a way I tried to block it out because of the result, because actually, you know, whenever anybody talked about it, they said, oh yeah, that was a great cup final. Oh, didn't you score in the second minute? And what was the score? Everybody always says, and what was the result? And obviously you then have to, and you recall it and you go, oh yeah, well, I know it was a great cup final, but we lost, and really I don't want to talk about it. And that was an amazing incident, because I was totally convinced that Keith Houchin scored the winning goal. And Keezy, being a Coventry supporter, always, whenever I met him, always said to me, remind me, he said, what was the score in the cup final, 87? So yeah, I've known him for a long time, and it wasn't. I basically just had to reboot. I had to look back, see the facts, and think, my goodness, it was Gary Mabbutt's own goal that was actually the winning goal.
Were there any other bits of your career that were almost revelations to you when you and James were going back and going through it all?
To be honest, not too many, because in terms of goal scoring, it's imprinted there in my mind. You can go back to certain games and I'll tell you, I'd hope to tell you the type of goal it was, how it came about, and what I actually did to finish it. It was just, that's just something that's imprinted there.
So the goals stick in your mind more than the games?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely. I remember playing at Grounds and I scored a goal there, and they're the things that for me that I remember. You know, I could talk you through my first ever goal at Villa Park. Where I came in off the left side, wound the ball from the corner of the 18-yard box into the far corner. I came on as a young 17-year-old for Queen's Park Rangers.
Yeah.
Obviously, my full debut against Coventry, a bog of a pitch at Loftus Road, and the first goal running through and firing it from outside the box into the top corner. So many goals are just there. They're in the bank there.
I mean, that's a goal scorer's thing, isn't it? It's something you hear Tony Cotty, one of your contemporaries,
absolutely,
talk about quite a lot. He's got a great recall for that. Jermaine Defoe famously had a scrapbook. I know you worked with Jermaine quite a lot. When you worked with Jermaine, did you see like a bit of yourself in him?
Yeah, and I think we struck up a really good relationship. And there were times when we were doing certain finishing sessions where there'd been particular chances in games that I'd seen as a coach watching him play, and I'd ask him, I'd say to him, Jermaine, you know, what was you actually thinking at that moment in time? And he'd say, and I'd say, well, perhaps if you'd have done this, and he'd go, how do you know that? And I'd say, well, actually, Jermaine, I've been there, and you know, I scored doing this. And there were times when he'd, you know, the ball might be under his feet and he'd strike the ball early and he'd score where the goalkeeper wasn't set and it was fired past him before the goalkeeper could react. And I remember times coming in the dressing room and saying, you know what, coach, he said, you know, that was it. And he'd go, yeah. So, and the one thing with Jermaine, I'm sure he's still got it today, you know, they're talking about him carrying on playing. Fantastic hat-trick for Rangers not too long ago.
Yeah.
And I think that he will, because he just, it's a drug to him. He loves playing. He loves scoring goals, and he'll continue to do that. I've thoroughly enjoyed working with him.
I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? I mean, like, in one way, it's seen in football terms as like a criticism of a striker to say that person is just a goal scorer or a pure goal scorer. Well, yeah, that's been seen to be the way in current times.
Well, I've got to say there that I actually thought of naming the book "He Only Scored Goals."
Oh, really?
Because that was something that was discussed. Obviously, the book is now called Up Front, but yeah, it, that was something that came into my head, because that was something that was levelled at me throughout my career. Well, yeah, yeah, Clive Allen, he only scored goals.
Which is funny, because obviously it's the most important part of football, isn't it?
It is, and that to me was why I thought it was, you know, it's something that I've heard, obviously. It's something that I understand. It's been levelled at me, but it's not a bad thing, to be honest.
No, and you know what? I think football has kind of come around full circle a little bit. I think you had that spell sort of starting in the 90s where that wasn't enough anymore, where people expected an all-round game, and I think to an extent they got that from players like Stan Collymore, who could do so much more.
Yeah.
But I think now when you look at a lot of modern European strikers, strikers in the European game, you look at Mauro Icardi, you look at Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, they're only alive when they're in the penalty box.
Lewandowski, so kind of there's a number now, I think. Yeah. Aguero. I think Aguero is the archetypal goal scorer.
Yeah.
That is his contribution team. It's massive. It's massive for the team. But also, you know, moving into coaching, when you are analysing players, and certainly for me, looking at strikers, the goal record was so important. And then it was always, well, what else do they give us? Are they quick? Can they hold the play up? Do they link the play? Do they come back? Do they create chances for their teammates? And it was almost like they became the overriding factors, rather than actually, if he plays, he scores a goal every two games.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that is massive but, for any team.
I mean, there's an argument as well that, say if I was a coach, for example, I would like my strikers to run less, or at least my main goal scorer to run less, because, I mean, I know you watch a lot of French football, Clive, and the thing that always strikes me about Edinson Cavani, he's a player who kind of splits opinion. I mean, I don't think there's much doubt that he's one of the greatest strikers out there of the last 10 years. But people don't think of him as totally cold in front of goal. And you look at his style of play, the fact that it covers every blade of grass.
Yeah.
I mean, how difficult is it to compose yourself when you've run 60 metres beforehand?
Well, exactly. And it takes away from your greatest strength. Mm. And I've actually said that to players that I've coached, strikers that I've worked with, that actually, we don't want you out on the touchline taking two or three touches, passing it back to the fullback, because when the fullback delivers that cross, you can't be in there, you can't be in a goal scoring position to take that chance.
Yeah.
Whereas if you almost let that build up take place, and you're central, you start from the edge of the box in the D and make those 5, whatever, 10 yard runs that get you into a goal scoring position, there's a chance you'll score. Not a chance you'll score. You will score, because that's what you're working towards. And sometimes I think strikers do lose that. They lose that instinct that it's, where should I be to score goals, rather than I need to be involved in the game, pick up the play, link the play. And that is something that I would always pick up and speak to strikers that I work with. And I think sometimes Harry has become a culprit of that recently.
Right.
Certainly in the last few months, when you look at his game, if he's in goal scoring positions and he gets chances, he scores goals, and he always will, because he has that instinct, he has that ability. But when he's out down the channels, he's back in his own half, he can't score goals from there.
People talk about his passing from deep an awful lot, and he is a really terrific passer with
absolutely
the ball. But would you like to see him do that less, almost?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that people say, well, Spurs are having a difficult time. Yes, but if you looked and you analysed Harry's game just solely, I bet he's had very few chances in terms of goal scoring opportunities to those that he had when it was really flowing last season or the season before. Goal scoring consistently was about the number of chances created for him and the positions that he was in to take those chances. And I would hazard a guess now, and I haven't done the research, but I think if someone looked at it, you'd find that he was definitely in goal scoring positions, being given more chances, and he scored more goals.
And so we're talking about Spurs, we're talking about goal scorers, we're inevitably going to end up talking about 86, 87 at Spurs. And, you know, I think it's quite right that we think of that as a pinnacle of your career.
Absolutely, yeah.
But having said that, you've been through a lot to get to that point in the first place, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that comes to mind straight away was the injury just a year before.
Mm.
I had the worst injury of my career. I was literally incapacitated for a whole year, not a season.
They couldn't figure out what it was.
No, I'd ruptured an adductor in my groin. It was there, and until surgery took place and it was repaired, that I recovered. I know how hard I worked to get back, and I was just desperate to get back playing football, because there were times in that period where, you know, I thought, I wonder what's wrong. There's something wrong, and we, you know, couldn't find the reason.
And people thought it was in your head.
Yeah, there was moments where, you know, obviously I'd had hernia repairs, and they thought that was the problem.
Yeah,
they were repaired, and I came back or tried to come back, but wasn't right. And it wasn't until the adductor tear was found that it was operated on, and I recovered over a period of time, and then obviously got back to the best form of my life, which was incredible.
Well, even before that, I mean, it's almost surreal, I think, looking back at some aspects of your career, and particularly the move to Arsenal,
yeah,
and then the move shortly after that to Crystal Palace. I mean, to kind of put this in a modern context, for Arsenal to pay a fee of over a million pounds.
1.25 million in 1980.
Yeah.
Which was the first million-pound transfer for a teenage player in the world. And it made front-page news. It was like, this game's gone mad. What's happened to football? How can Arsenal pay this much money for a teenage footballer?
But for them to buy you, and then Terry Neill and Don Howe to turn around 6 weeks later and go, it's not working out, without you having played a actual proper first team game. Obviously, you played a little
two,
bit.
Two and a half pre-season games.
Two
yeah.
and a half pre-season games. Yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of a Premier League club going out, spending 60 million on a striker, and then 6 weeks later,
a teenage striker.
And then deciding, no, this is a terrible idea. I mean, it's funny, that was one of the things reading back in the book. We're talking about how going back, and it was maybe a little bit therapeutic for you. But do you still struggle a bit to make sense of that?
Yeah, because it was bizarre. And again, when you put it into context and you try to equate it with a modern game today, it's not going to happen, is it? I don't think...
They wouldn't be able to shift you for a start.
That's right, exactly. And certainly, you know, it was extraordinary. It really was. But I always say, and I say to this day, I say in the book, that it certainly, I was 18 and I grew up. I was a boy, really, going from QPR to Arsenal. But I do think that when I moved from Arsenal, with everything that entailed, to Crystal Palace, I had to become a man. I had to, in a way, I had to toughen up. And I think I had a really fortunate upbringing, in respect that I knew football. I lived in and around the football club at Queen's Park Rangers growing up.
Yeah.
My father's influence, the advice that he'd given me, and I was lucky in that respect, but I tell you what, it was quite an experience. It really was.
And it was fairly rocky when you got to Palace as well, because they were really struggling, and it got tougher as the season went on.
Yeah, team of the 80s, a really talented young group of players who'd all come through together at Palace. I was the outsider, although I knew those players. I'd played with Vince Allaire, Billy Gilbert, a number of players at England youth level. Terry Venables was the manager. We started the season, we went to Liverpool, the champions, lost on the opening day of the season, and it was difficult. It was a difficult, to come into the top flight, and it wasn't going all their way. Mm. Obviously, that was the first time, I felt, looking back on it, it was the first time that those Crystal Palace youngsters had come under that sort of pressure and also, you know, scrutiny, because they were great players. It was a superb team. But actually, you know, this was the real world, and they were finding it difficult.
So were you almost expected to take a senior role because of what you'd cost and the profile you had, despite the fact that age-wise you were actually quite close to those players?
Yeah, I think there was no leeway. It was like, you know, you were bought to score goals. You have to come in here and you have to score, outscore anyone, because they paid that money, they transferred, swapped Kenny for yourself. So there was big expectations, definitely.
Mm. So later on, when you come back from France after leaving Bordeaux, you ended up at Manchester City. And they had an interesting set of young players themselves, didn't they? And, you know, you think of that 5-1 game. I know you were out injured for that game.
I was,
when,
yes.
When they beat Manchester United 5-1 in 89, which is a result that really sticks in my head from my childhood. You think of how good... David White was in that game, Andy Hinchcliffe, players like that, of course.
Steve Redmond.
Paul Lake, of course, we know what happened to him because
Amazing talent, injuries
and whatnot. What do you think was the difference between a group of players like that and, you know, that team of the 80s at Palace and say the Manchester United team of the mid-90s, because the reason that, say, that United team went on and achieved all that they were meant to achieve and the others didn't, I mean, it's not just down to talent, is it?
No, no, absolutely not. It is having that, it's having that desire mentality, dealing with what might be criticism at a young age as well. Mm. And in a way, I was in a different position at City because of the experiences I'd had. I was 30. I'd come back from France. I'd just about experienced everything that I could have done in a playing career.
Yeah.
And had a really good rapport with those young players, and they were talents. It was an emerging Manchester City at that time. Mm. That they'd been promoted to the top flight. They predominantly were young. Obviously, there was a number of more experienced players that were added. Gary Megson came in.
Yeah.
Colin Hendry came in at the same day that I signed for Manchester City. Yeah. So there was the Mel Machin, who was the manager at the time, realised that although he had these good young talents, he needed some experience bolted onto that as well.
So, if we go back to 86-87, the outstanding season of your career, and again, it's something that really sticks in my mind from my childhood, because it's the first season that I really watched football regularly, 86-87, and you were absolutely unstoppable. I mean, 49 goals, that's something that didn't really happen then. I know in the era of Messi and Ronaldo, we've become almost desensitized to those sort of numbers. But for them, it was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, presumably you felt good coming into the season, but did you feel like anything like that was possible?
No, and to be honest, I never ever thought or never had a target until right at the very end of the season.
When the 50 was close.
Yeah, when the 50 was close, and going into the cup final, last game of the season, as it always was then, I needed two goals to get to 50. There was Jimmy Greaves' record at 46, which he'd reminded me about right at the start of the season when he interviewed me for the Saint and Greavesy show, his TV show at the time. Yeah. And Jimmy said to me, and I knew Jimmy because he'd actually come to Tottenham when my dad played there. And people have always said he sort of came in and replaced my dad, who played in the double side.
Yeah.
Dad always told me that he was the greatest goal scorer he'd ever seen. He said, there's no doubt there'll never be a goal scorer like Jimmy Greaves. And there I was, 10 games into the season, sitting with Jimmy Greaves interviewing me. And he says to me, you carry on like this, son. I had 10 goals in 11 games. He said, you could break my record. And I didn't even, to be honest, didn't even know about it at that time. And I just went, no, you're joking, Jim. No one's going to break that record. And that was 46, which I broke on semi-final day at Villa Park. And then
when you played Watford.
When we played Watford.
Yeah.
And then went on to amass 49 with the first goal in that 87 Cup final. So it was strange because people said, well, you must 50 must have been your target. I would never have envisaged 50 being the target and aiming for that. It was, I'm going to score as many goals as I can today, given the chances that the team created. And the way the team was set up was perfect for me, perfect for a lot of the individuals that were in that team. And David Pleat has to take a lot of credit for that.
And it was a very, very special Tottenham side, isn't it? I mean, you know,
it was a great,
I think when we talk of Tottenham, like, older fans will think of that 60-61 team that your dad played in.
That was the best team ever. And obviously I grew up listening to that.
Yeah.
And every, for me, the way I describe it, every Tottenham team since has been trying to live up to that double side, and rightly so.
Yeah.
Incredible feat. But what they did was just something that is very unlikely to be repeated.
Well, I mean, there's that famous thing after they lost the semi-final in the European Cup the following year, where Bella Gutmann, the Benfica coach, says to them, well, after the game, Tottenham are going to win the European Cup in the next couple of years. It's inevitable. And then, obviously, they go 40-odd years without even being in it.
Yeah.
And I think now, like, in a more modern sense, people look at Harry's side that got in the Champions League.
Which I worked with
him. Yeah, of course, and they think of the team last year that got in the Champions League final. But because you guys didn't win a trophy, I mean, do you understand where people are coming from now when they say that Pochettino needs a trophy almost to set it off? I mean,
absolutely,
Because you guys, you played that epic season for a point in 86-87 on the back of your goals and all the fantastic football. You were there or thereabouts at the top of the table. You got to the semi-finals of the League Cup. You got to the final of the FA Cup.
Yeah.
I mean, how hard is it to say that we didn't end up with a trophy?
It was very, very tough. It was tough because I think people enjoyed the football we played.
Mm.
I would say it was the Tottenham way in respect that, you know, we played the game that we knew if we conceded we could outscore the opposition.
Yeah.
And that was, I think that was something that David had instilled in us.
Yeah.
Obviously he wanted us to be, you know, rock solid at the back. We did let goals in, but we always had that confidence that we could score. With, you know, Chris Waddle, Glenn Hoddle, my cousin Paul, myself, there was goal scorers in the team.
Yeah.
That we always felt, yeah, we'll beat you 4-3 or 2-1 or 3-2. That was the way we played, and I think we entertained. And as you say, we went very, very close without winning anything. Unfortunately, the team broke up very quickly the following season.
Yeah.
With Glenn going and other things, but it was a fantastic team to play.
I mean, the talent in that team was absolutely unbelievable. As you say, and I think, you know, people think of Arsenal pulling away from Tottenham in the Arsene Wenger years, for example.
Yeah.
But at that point, there was no doubt who the best team in North London were, which I guess must have made it so tough getting over losing to them in the League Cup semi.
Because
for younger people, there are no away goals in the semi then. So after they came back and won the game in the second leg at White Hart Lane, because you guys had been 2-0 up on aggregate, they ended up going to a replay.
That's right, he did, yeah. And the chairman tossed for venue for the third game.
Right.
And Irving Scholar, the then chairman of Tottenham, won the toss and we played at home.
Yeah.
And I remember it well. It's a 6 minutes of my career as a player that I'll never forget, because I score. Mm. So we're in front again over the course of nearly three games.
Yes.
We're in front with 6 minutes to go. Richard Gough headed it down and I smashed it into the corner.
Yeah.
And it was, right, this is it. We're going to Wembley.
Mm.
And I always say, Charlie Nicholas turned his ankle. He went off.
Yeah.
Ian Allanson came on. First touch, he scored. 1-1, equaliser. And the late David Rocastle scored in, I think it was the 93rd or 4th minute.
Wow.
To win the game 2-1, for them to go through. They went through to play Liverpool in the final, and Charlie Nicholas scored two goals to beat Liverpool 2-0 in the final at Wembley. I'll never forget that, because it was like, and that was the first dressing room that I've walked into where there was, your teammates are literally slumped in the corner on the floor on the treatment table crying, and I walk in with two bottles of champagne. A crazy guy presents me with two bottles of champagne as I'm walking down the tunnel, having just got, basically, you know, you feel as if you've just been robbed.
Yeah.
And he says, come on, smile. And I'm like, and it was the sponsors giving me two bottles of champagne because I'd broken the League Cup goal scoring record that season with 13 goals. My goal was the 13th. And again, these things stick in your mind. It was Sir Geoff Hurst and Rodney Marsh, who played with my dad in 67 to win the League Cup for Queen's Park Rangers, who scored 12 goals in one season's competition. And I scored 13, and I'd to this day still hold that record. And I'll never forget it. And there's me walking in with two bottles of champagne, and the guys are crying in the dressing room.
I mean, that's one of those images that, you know, you don't really associate with football, isn't it?
Yeah,
Because, you know, you think of the glory and like the heroic persona of the players when they're on the pitch. I remember like years ago speaking to Michel Bastos, who used to play for Lyon, and he was saying that when they got knocked out of the 2010 World Cup in South Africa by the Netherlands in the quarterfinals, he said he came back into the dressing room, and once you've got the squad of 23, all the support staff, and he said you're sat in a dressing room with 40 blokes all crying their eyes out. And that's something that, you know, you're not used to hearing from football at all. That's something that I think came across quite nicely in the book. You managed to touch on the more vulnerable side of stuff. You talked about like your own doubts as well.
Yeah.
And one thing that I thought was really interesting, I mean, you're clearly a player who knew your own mind, and you know, you didn't, like, for example, when you first offered the move to Manchester City from Bordeaux, you said no and you stuck with it even though the club wanted to get rid of you. But something that's very clear in that is that the player power as we know it today simply didn't exist in your
Absolutely.
Era. Do you wonder how your career might have been different if it had have been, I don't know, 15 years or 20 years further forward?
Well, yeah, I think you always try to imagine what it might be like. And obviously the nature of the game, the finances that are involved now. I would have, certainly would have been in, I would say, a position of power in terms of, one, negotiating contracts, because of, again, because if you look at my career over the course, the goals that I'd scored, you know, that comes at a premium and a price today, as it did then.
You never had an agent, did you?
No, I didn't. I used Dennis Roach when I went to Bordeaux, because obviously going abroad,
you don't know the market.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was the first time that I used, or the necessity for an agent was there. He did a fine job for me, but that was something that was alien to me until that point. Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
So you do go to Bordeaux in 88, and it's different, isn't it?
Everything. The whole experience is different.
I mean, you had it in your mind to go abroad for quite a while. Why Bordeaux?
Well, what happened, I was 28. I went out of contract. So although it was freedom of contract, it wasn't freedom of contract.
They still had to pay.
They would have had to pay a transfer fee, agreeing with Spurs. But I was as free as a player to negotiate with whoever or talk to whoever I want.
Yeah.
It was that stage of my career that was the only time that I was going to be in that position, that I could actually control my destiny, where I was going to go. I'd always had that feeling that I wanted to play abroad. I would have loved to have gone and played in Italy. I think the challenge of trying to score goals in Italian football at that time was something that I just felt would be the biggest challenge that I could have faced. Bordeaux made an early move in terms of before my contract actually finished in the summer, so it was March, April before the contract was running out. They negotiated with Spurs agreed a transfer fee. And it was a case of me negotiating with them, which I did. Everything was favourable. Bordeaux was a big football club in French football over that decade.
It was,
and I obviously I spoke to people who knew about French football then, and this description I was given was, this is the Liverpool of France. This is the Liverpool who win either win the league, win the Ligue 1 Cup, or play in Europe. So all those things were a big attraction. I was going into the unknown, there was no doubt about it, or I didn't know what to expect, but I wanted to experience it.
What about the first day when you arrive? Because at the training ground at Le Havre, there's that huge chateau in the middle. It's not getting changed in a port cabin, is it?
No, not at all. No, it was really dramatic. And obviously, over the years with my career in England, some of the training grounds were very basic, unlike they are today.
Yeah, and even Chelsea, I guess, when you were there.
Yeah, that's right. They was out at near Heathrow Airport. You know, windswept, open, almost. There was training grounds that had porter cabins that, no problem, because I love training. But all of a sudden, you come into this sweeping drive, beautiful chateau, and it's like, wow, what is this? Down into the cellars, which were beautiful in terms of the medical facilities, the hydropool, the whole thing. And again, that was in a way, a whole new experience. The way that you know, your conditioning, everything. It was a new education for me, it really was.
Well, I mean, when you worked out that training was different, conditioning was different, diet was different, and this is still in the late 80s.
Yeah.
With that, and when I think post-career, when you were a kicker for the London Broncos for a bit, which again is a completely different world, and you talk in the book about how thorough the physical tests are, and the education, attention to your technique, exactly. Yeah. When you went forward into coaching, how did what you took from Bordeaux and that NFL experience affect the way that you coached?
I thought it was fantastic. It was a great help, because I just felt it gave me more knowledge, having experienced that. In a way, I knew of the old school way, because I'd been brought up through apprenticeship and coming through, and the way that, you know, you trained and you worked as a young player developing, obviously through the 80s. And then to have that experience and then moving into coaching yourself, managed to, you know, I managed to combine a lot of that knowledge into the way that I coached. And I think it helped me. It was a great education. It really was.
I mean, do you almost wish it had happened earlier in your career? I mean, in terms of like a technical perspective, you talked about how the players worked a lot more on technique rather than it just being considered as a given, because you've got that far, and you know you're working with young players who are coming through, like who we know, like Vicente Lizarazu, Christophe Dugarry, players like that.
That's right, and seeing them come through Bordeaux's academy, the way that they obviously, the way that they worked there, the way that they, you know, the sessions that they had, the technical sessions, seeing them work was almost a forerunner to what we now understand as the norm here, that with the influence of, and I've got to say, a coach like Arsene Wenger arriving and then starting to instill that type of philosophy and system. I was fortunate to experience it, obviously at the latter end of my career, but I think that helped me in my coaching days.
I mean, in terms of when you were still a player and you went back from Bordeaux to Manchester City, was there any sense of you saying, well, this is how they do it in Bordeaux and maybe that would work for you? Or were people quite closed and set in their ways?
No, those questions were asked. Obviously, Mel Machin was the manager there. They and they asked, you know, what we'd been doing there, how it worked. But it was the old school way. It was the long runs, pre-season training. It wasn't perhaps the two or three sessions a day. It was a tough physical pre-season that we did at City. But it wasn't structured in the same way that I'd experienced in my time in France. And I do think, you know, there's pros and cons to it all, and it's finding that right blend and happy medium. But it has certainly moved towards that. So much more is known, the physiology of the players, the psychology of the players now. Yes. And players have to buy into that these days. They have to understand that. And I think that the education now at the clubs, certainly the Premier League clubs, with the academies and the way they're in place, facilities at Spurs, which obviously I know of, are second to none. The opportunity for these young talents to develop themselves is absolutely extraordinary.
So what about the actual football at Bordeaux? I mean, to an extent, it must have been a pinnacle. And certainly in retrospect, you look at some of the players you played with, like Jean Tigana, Eric Cantona.
Eric came, yeah.
Arrived as well. And, you know, you
played. Enzo Schifo was the Belgium centre-half, centre midfield player. Wonderful players, great talents. And obviously, you know, it was just such an experience. Mm. And before going, it was something that I want to experience. Mm. And afterwards, it was something that I always said, I'm glad I did that. It was important that I did that as part of my career. The opportunity was there, and I'm glad I took that opportunity.
I mean, how was Cantona? I mean, he came with a certain reputation already.
Enfant terrible.
Yeah.
He was crazy. He was talented. He was young, naive.
Yeah.
But he had an arrogance about him even at that time. Obviously, his career was in turmoil in terms of what happened with him, with his coach, and you know, it's all documented. He threw his shirt in the coach's face when substituting, and
banned from the national team.
Banned from the national team. He's not going to play in French football again. All of a sudden, he turns up at Bordeaux, which was something that was. It was crazy, but you could see he was a talent, and it was 3 months. I played with Eric for 3 months, and then didn't bump into him until, ironically, I was at West Ham, and he'd just arrived at Leeds.
Yeah,
and I was getting off the coach at Elland Road as a West Ham player, and he was walking into the ground. And he turned to me, Clive, what are you doing? So I said, I'm a West Ham player now, Eric, and he was like. As he just walked off. But you know, Eric was, well, we all know what he did at Manchester United.
Yeah.
And he had that presence, he had the ability. And Manchester United, when again you look at players' careers, Manchester United was the theatre that he needed. It was the platform that he needed to show what he was capable of.
But when you talk about the improbability of him turning up at Bordeaux in the first place, I mean, was that a typical Claude Bez move? Because, of course, the president...
Bernard Tapie, Claude Bez,
I mean, he was... Like, people talk about Bernard Tapie, but I think it's sometimes even easy to overlook the fact that Claude Bez was one of the personalities of French football in the 1980s. I mean, he's very much a larger-than-life character.
Absolutely.
What was it like working with him, and what was your first impressions when you originally signed for Bordeaux?
It was amazing. He wasn't the tallest man. He had the long moustache.
Mm.
You could see that he was a powerful person. It was quite an experience. It wasn't too long, probably 6 weeks in, that I got the call. I had to go to his house, and there I was sitting there. And as I walk in, Clive, you're a great player, but you must go away. Sorry, Mr. President, what do you mean? You must go away.
It's like Arsenal all over again, but just in French. Like,
yeah, but... Why? What? It's not working. It's not working, and it happened a couple of times through the season until obviously the end of the season that I moved and come back to England. But and Tigana, who was club captain, who got changed next to me on the very first time that Aimé Jacquet, who was coach, come in, he said, "Oh, Clive, you must see the president at 5 o'clock at his house." And I turned to John, just said, "What is that?" And he just waved. He went, "Well, fire, Clive." He's like, "What are you talking about?" It's just, but so you're in a foreign country. You've got a club that have bought you. Then all of a sudden they don't. But I would say that even then, obviously, because of those experiences I had at a very young age, the QPR, Arsenal, Palace scenario, that it was like, "Oh, okay, I can deal with this. I can handle it."
Yeah.
So that experience early on. Really, I think, really held me in good stead as I moved forward through my career with transfers and rumour mill and possibly going, staying or whatever. I could handle it. I could deal with it.
And I guess the thing that comes across in the book as well is that on a personal level, it was quite a tricky time for you and your family at Bordeaux with some stuff that you were going through. I mean, they didn't handle it particularly... well. Is that what made you come back to England? Or you just needed the family at that time?
Yeah, I think it was. We lost a son. Charles was stillborn, which was obviously very, very tragic, a really, really difficult time. And the club didn't handle that period particularly well. And I think I realised there that it just was about what I did as a footballer. There perhaps wasn't the support that I needed.
Did you feel as if you were just treated as collateral?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. That was the way it was. That was the way it unfolded. That was the experience I went through. The experience we went through.
Was that a thing for footballers generally, or was that specifically with Bordeaux?
I think it was an indicator as to generally. I can't say that about all the clubs. No, because. I hadn't experienced that before. Obviously, I'd experienced the transfer of Arsenal, but it wasn't the same sort of circumstances. But no, there was, I think, and again, it's only in hindsight and looking back that you realise exactly what was happening at Bordeaux, and it wasn't till many years later that I found out about the Claude Bez and his wheeling, dealing, his trading, the way he used players in the transfers that the club went through.
And of course, eventually, post playing career, you end up back at Spurs. You park some very exciting times, some very interesting times. First with Martin Yoller's coach, and then later under Harry Redknapp. When Spurs got back into the Champions League after winning that game at Manchester City, and then you went through. I mean, I think people forget it now a little bit because of what happened in the Champions League last season. But that was extraordinary. From the point where you were 3-0 down at Young Boys in the first round of the playoff. To the bit where you're 4-0 down against Inter and Gareth Bale goes absolutely crazy, to the return of that when Bale tears Maicon to shreds again. It's an extraordinary Champions League run. And with your experience of the European game, how much were you able to offer, do you think, in terms of preparing for that?
Well, I think, obviously, we were treading new ground as a football club to be in the Champions League. First time Tottenham Hotspur had been in the Champions League, the qualification stage into the group stage, which, you know, when that draw was made and we got Young Boys, there was some fist pumping. It was like, because that was, if there was the ideal draw, it was Young Boys Burn, no disrespect to them, but what an opportunity for us to be in that Champions League group stage. As we did, we prepared in the same way that we did for every game. I went to Burn, watched them play, watched them lose a league home game at home the Saturday before we were going there to play them in the Champions League knockout. And come back to say to Harry, as you would, report back what you see. Harry, we'll be all right. There's not a problem. We turn up, we play, you know, anywhere near our capabilities. We're going to go through it. We've got an unbelievable chance. Of course, 3-0 down or whatever it was after 20 minutes, and he's standing in the technical, turns to me, "You said we were going through." And it's like, oh my God, Harry, look. We are going through. Don't worry. It's like, but, you know, that was the roller coaster. I know it was Basson, I think, who scored the second goal, which obviously got us back in touch, and we won the corresponding second leg at White Hart Lane comfortably to go through. But again, I think it was that, just that experience. We needed that experience. We needed to understand the level. It was the next level. It was, you know, how you have to perform in the Champions League. And then moving into the group stage as we did. We didn't get a particularly easy group. But it was that you saw then the players who were able to just not lift their game, but were able to produce at the level that was necessary then. Werder Bremen, and then we obviously had the games against Inter, and it was amazing, absolutely amazing. And the players were growing at that time as well, so... the whole experience was important, but I think having played abroad, in a way you sort of understand maybe your oppositions, the mentality, the way that you like to think that you know what they're thinking, and you're able to portray that to the players.
So I guess finally, another thing that really comes across in the book is like when you're coaching, it's about trying to recreate the buzz, and I think a lot of old players find that, don't they? Trying to recreate the buzz that you miss of, you know, the dressing room, the excitement of the game itself, all that sort of stuff. When you think of those nights at the old White Hart Lane, especially when, you know, Inter and Real Madrid come, did that come close at least?
It does as a coach. Yeah. You can't recreate being a player going across the right line. There's nothing that comes close to that.
Mm.
The involvement as a coach, and hopefully the influence or the impact that you can have on the players, it's a different feeling, but it's a rewarding feeling. And just to be part of it, just to, you know, the highs and lows, the ups and downs, which are obviously there, they're always there. It's like a drug. It's a drug that you can't be without. And obviously, personally, it's a way of life. It's what I know. It's what I love, and it was what I wanted to do. So I enjoyed every minute of it. I was passionate about it, and I hope that comes through in the book, that, you know, I'm passionate about the game of football. I love it. I love that. I love the game.
Thanks so much for joining us, Clive.
Pleasure.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.